From CPR News, this is Colorado Matters. A total solar eclipse will cover a large swath of the U.S. from Texas to Maine April 8th. Colorado will darken a little. A Boulder author and eclipse chaser recommends seeing it in all its glory.
Suddenly, the sky that you know is gone. The blue sky gets ripped away, and you can actually look into space toward the center of the solar system.
David Barron, formerly of NPR, explains why a full eclipse has the power to bring Americans together. Also, signs that say speed monitored by aircraft are certainly deterrents.
Our goal is voluntary compliance. We want everybody to think there's an airplane up there all the time.
Is there? Plus, pilot and Harvard grad student Madison Marsh. Oh, she's also Miss America.
Is that old car of yours taking up valuable space? Free up some room and make a difference by donating it to Colorado Public Radio. The process is safe and easy. You just have to find the title and the keys, and we'll handle the rest. The proceeds of your gift go into CPR's operating budget. Fuel the news and music you rely on by donating your car. Find out how on the support page at cpr.org.
This is Colorado Matters from CPR News and KRCC. I'm Ryan Warner. A total solar eclipse crosses the country from Texas to Maine in 3 weeks, April 8th. Colorado will see a partial darkening. Journalist David Barron has witnessed 8 such events. He wrote a book about one way back in 1878, titled American Eclipse, a nation's epic race to catch the shadow of the moon and the glory of the world. Barron, a former NPR science correspondent, lives in Boulder. He spoke with Andrea Dukakis.
A total solar eclipse is when the moon comes directly between the Earth and the sun, completely blocking the face of the sun for a few minutes. You've witnessed these before. What would you say to someone who's never, ever experienced it?
It really is an experience you should have at least once in your life. And if you have it once in your life, you will probably want to have it again. I saw my first total eclipse in 1998, and I got hooked. I now have seen 8 total eclipses on 5 continents, and I'm going to keep seeing as many as I can as long as I'm on Earth.
What about it is so exciting and jaw-dropping?
It is the closest thing to space travel that you can experience without leaving the surface of the Earth. It really is as if you have been transported briefly to another planet. Suddenly, the sky that you know is gone. As soon as the moon completely blocks the face of the sun and the total eclipse begins, the blue sky gets ripped away, and you can actually look into space toward the center of the solar system, and you're seeing a sky you've never seen before. It's partly the colors are spectacular. You'll see planets up in the sky in the middle of the day. And of course, the most spectacular thing you will see is the sun itself, which even though the surface of the sun is blocked, what you can see during a total eclipse is the sun's atmosphere, its outer atmosphere called the solar corona. And I tell you, it's just the most glorious sight in the heavens. It's like a wreath or a crown, and it's so brief. You know, at most, it'll be a few minutes, and then it's over. And you wonder, what did I just witness? And many people want to see it again.
And how long exactly will this one last?
So the one this year, if you're in the right spot, will last as long as 4.5 minutes. And that's actually a very long total eclipse. The path of this total eclipse will go from Texas to Maine. And in Texas, if you're in the middle of the path, you could get 4.5 minutes. By the time the moon's shadow reaches Maine, the moon's shadow will be moving faster and the total eclipse will last as long as 3.5 minutes. But to put this in perspective, many listeners probably went to see the total eclipse in 2017. Up in Wyoming or Nebraska, that one lasted only about 2.5 minutes. So this one is almost twice as long if you're in part of Texas.
Describe what to expect in Colorado with the partial solar eclipse.
So Colorado will see a pretty good partial eclipse. In Denver, it'll be about 70% at its peak. it begins as a partial eclipse around 11:30 in the morning and reaches its peak about 12:40 in the afternoon. It'll be subtle. In order to see it, you'll need to protect your eyes. The best thing to do is to get eclipse glasses, which you may already have, either from the eclipse in 2017, or you may remember there was what was called an annular eclipse that went over the Four Corners region last October. And if you still have your eclipse glasses, take them out. If you don't, go get them. Some libraries have them. You can buy them online, get them at hardware stores. And through these eclipse glasses that have extremely dark lenses, you can look at the sun safely. And you'll see the moon slowly move in front of the sun and the sun become a crescent. But at a 70% partial eclipse, you really won't notice much different in the environment. The day will seem as bright as ever. If you look under trees, however, you may notice where the light is filtering between branches, little crescents all over the ground, because the spaces between the branches will act as pinhole projectors, projecting the image of the crescent sun on the ground. So it will be fun, and anyone who's in Colorado should be sure to go out and enjoy it safely. But it's going to be a whole other experience if you're in the path of the total eclipse.
You mentioned Texas for this one. We've heard that flights there are crazy expensive, and there are warnings about traffic jams. Where do you expect the bulk of watchers to be?
So the path of this eclipse goes from Texas to Maine, and most serious eclipse chasers are going to Texas. And that's for two reasons. One is that it will last longer in Texas than it will up in New England. But more importantly, Texas has much better odds of clear skies. And if you're under overcast skies, you're going to miss the spectacle. And in Texas, the better odds of clear skies are toward the south and the west. So generally, people are saying, you know, that the best place to go in terms of odds of clear skies would be the Texas Hill Country west of San Antonio. But that's an area with small towns and small roads. And in fact, one town, Kerrville, that's got a population of 25,000. One estimate I saw said they may see 500,000 visitors that day. So it will be crazy. But the path of totality, as it's called, also goes over part of Austin. It goes over Dallas and Fort Worth. And it goes over Waco, which is where I will be.
How does viewing a total solar eclipse differ from a partial one, like the one people will be able to see in Denver, in terms of the danger of hurting your eyes?
Excellent question. So it is never safe to look at the bright surface of the sun with the naked eye. Whether it's on just a typical day, you would never even think to look at the sun. During a partial eclipse, it's the same thing. It's not like the sun is giving off especially dangerous rays during an eclipse. But even at a 70% partial eclipse, like in Denver, if you were to look at the sun, you might burn a crescent-shaped scar in the back of your eye, which you do not want to do. So at any time that it's a partial eclipse, you must protect your eyes. However, if you are in the path where it's going to be total, during the period when it's total, which again is only 4.5 minutes or less, during that time, it is safe to look at the sun with the naked eye because the bright surface is covered and all you're seeing is the sun's atmosphere, which is about as bright as a full moon. So it's not going to hurt your eyes. But even if you're in the path where it is total, it begins as a partial eclipse for over an hour and it ends as a partial eclipse for over an hour. So wherever you are, you'll want to be able to protect your eyes.
The book we mentioned at the beginning came out back in 2017, but a revised version of it just came out. And in it, you reflect on the 2017 total solar eclipse. It was closer to Colorado, Wyoming, as you said. What's important to know about the total eclipse of 2017?
Well, I think probably most folks will remember it was a really big deal. First of all, this was a time when our country was in turmoil. You know, it was the beginning of the Trump administration, and you had people fighting on both sides of what seemed to be an insurmountable divide of red versus blue America. Just a week before the total eclipse was the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville that turned deadly. The nation almost felt like it was on the verge of civil war. And yet, on this one day, August 21st of 2017, everyone was focused on the same thing and really having the same reaction. The entire country came together with wall-to-wall coverage on TV. Folks flocked into the path of totality if they could, or if they were elsewhere where it was a partial eclipse, people gathered at stadiums and at libraries to share this moment of awe at the universe, something completely apolitical. And it was remarkable how many people on that day talked about how nice it was at this time of great division in America for people to come together and just share a moment of togetherness. And I think we will see that again on April 8th of this year. There is something about a total solar eclipse, just how spectacularly beautiful it is, and the reminder of our insignificance in this enormous universe that humbles us, that makes us feel collectively as one instead of individuals. And the eclipse that's coming up on April 8th of this year will be an even bigger deal. It will be seen by more people. The one in 2017, although it went all the way from Oregon to South Carolina, it passed over regions of the country that are sparsely populated, like Wyoming and Nebraska. This one goes from Texas to Maine across some of the most populated parts of the country. Over 30 million people are in the path of the total eclipse this year. So about 1 in 10 Americans will see the total eclipse from home, and more than half the population of the United States lives within a day's drive of the path of totality. So it's going to be crazy. Indiana is saying it's going to be the biggest tourist event in that state's history. Texas, as you said, is expecting just apocalyptic traffic, but for a very good reason, because everyone wants to see this.
And your book's main focus is the eclipse of 1878, which in many ways is also a portrait of that time in history. Can you describe America at that time?
So 1878, we were, of course, a young country. We had only turned 100 years old 2 years before that. I think of us as sort of an adolescent nation at that point. We were kind of coming into our own. And we were, by 1878, a real economic power on the world scene. But when it came to intellectual pursuits, the Europeans looked down their noses at us. I mean, when it came to art and music and literature and science, the Europeans considered themselves the center of Western culture. But this was an opportunity in 1878 for the United States to challenge that when it came to science, because total eclipses in that era were very important for astronomy. Whenever a total eclipse occurred really anywhere on the planet, these grand expeditions would be sent off for astronomers to go study the eclipsed sun. And in 1878, when a total solar eclipse crossed the United States, in fact, Colorado and the Wild West at that time, it was a chance for America to show that we could do science too, that we should be taken seriously in this intellectual realm.
Hmm. For Coloradans, how big a deal was that eclipse?
Oh, it was huge. First, just to say, even in 1878, astronomers knew how to predict eclipses. This didn't come as a surprise. Astronomers knew it well in advance, years in advance, that this was going to happen. They mapped out quite accurately the path that the moon's shadow would take across the state. There were eclipse tours that came to Colorado. You know, just like we were saying about Texas being overrun by tourists, Denver was overrun by tourists in 1878. There were no hotel rooms left. People ended up sleeping on cots in hotel hallways and dining rooms because there were no real rooms left anymore. And a total eclipse really was just as big a deal then as it is now. And that's one of the things I really enjoyed about writing the book and delving into history, is that a total solar eclipse is just a deeply human experience that really hasn't changed over the centuries. You know, if we were to meet those people in 1878 and have a conversation with them, they would seem like, you know, they're from another world or another country, at least. Their thought processes would be unusual. Their use of language would seem a little odd. Their dress would be very strange. Their, of course, technology is completely different. And yet, the way those folks in 1878 described the emotional experience of seeing the sun go away in the middle of the day and having this beautiful vista open up overhead is exactly the same language people use today. Hmm.
Going much farther back, could you talk a little bit about the rituals and the myths that have surrounded eclipses for many, many years?
Well, obviously, in ancient times, they were a great source of fear and mystery. And, you know, there were astronomers who were really astrologers at that time who were given the task of predicting eclipses because it was often seen as a bad omen and you didn't want to be caught by surprise. So the court astrologers of various kings would try to predict these eclipses. And actually, even in ancient times, say the ancient Chinese did have a sense of when eclipses would happen. They didn't understand what was happening in terms of the orbit of the moon and the earth around the sun and all that. But eclipses recur in a cycle. Any given total eclipse, any given lunar eclipse will come back to earth a little over 18 years later. And the ancient Chinese, the ancient Greeks figured that out, even though they didn't really understand what was happening. But the Chinese during eclipses, during solar eclipses, they would beat gongs and drums because they thought it was a dragon eating the sun and they had to scare the dragon off. In ancient times, there was a war in Asia Minor that was being fought for years. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the day, the sun went away and the warriors decided this was a sign that they needed to stop fighting. And the war ended because of an eclipse.
Well, if people miss the April eclipse, when will the next one be?
Well, the next total solar eclipse to visit the lower 48 United States won't be until 2044. That will be up in Montana. But in 2045, so just 21 years from now, a really spectacular total solar eclipse will cross the country from California to Florida, and that one will cross Colorado. And that's going to be one not to miss. The path of the total eclipse will go just south of Denver and down over Colorado Springs and Pueblo and over Pikes Peak. And the duration of the total eclipse will be more than 5 minutes, which is a really long time for a total eclipse. And in fact, I am planning on August 12th to 2045 to be on top of Pikes Peak because I want to have the view that some folks had in 1878 that I learned about when I was writing my book. It was a small group of eclipse watchers on top of Pikes Peak, and they saw the moon's shadow coming in at 2,000 miles an hour from the northwest. And they could see this curtain of black that was just racing over the landscape, and the distant peaks that were in sunlight suddenly popped out of sight as the darkness zoomed in, and they just felt the moon's shadow wash over them.
David, thank you.
My pleasure.
David Barron of Boulder is a former NPR science correspondent and the author of American Eclipse. He spoke with Andrea Dukakis about the total solar eclipse that'll cross from Texas to Maine April 8th. And if you're thinking, Ryan, wouldn't it be Maine to Texas? The answer is no. As Scientific American explained in a recent article, the motion of the moon's shadow, not the sun, is what matters. As the moon passes across the face of the sun, it casts its shadow in the same direction in which it is moving. So that's from west to east. All right, back in a moment with Colorado Matters from CPR News.
This election season, CPR will be a go-to destination for fact-based, insightful national and local coverage, online and on the radio. Through sponsorship, your business can help fund the ongoing effort to bring trustworthy news and information to all of Colorado. And because CPR does not accept political advertising, we can deliver an uncluttered, unbiased platform for your message. Don't get lost in the crowd. Stand out and make an impact. Learn about sponsoring CPR at cpr.org.
A librarian scoured the archives for clips about abortion before it was legal in Colorado. He found century-old articles that echo today's debate. Here's CPR health reporter John Daly.
So right now we're standing in the Mullen Room.
Alex Hernandez works in the Denver Public Library's Special Collections Department.
This is on the fifth floor of the library. In the
Spread out on a table, some of his research. A few years ago, he learned about old newspaper ads spanning more than 100 years, dating back from before Colorado became a state. They were for abortifacients, substances and medications that cause abortions.
The more I started digging into this, I started seeing the names of women and girls who had gone through this.
What he found fascinated and troubled him. Before Roe, the practice was outlawed, so desperate women and girls sought to terminate their pregnancies, sometimes self-performed, sometimes from the providers of the day, sometimes with unregulated abortifacients. When things went awry, it could create grim headline news.
A lot of these women died pretty horribly, either from blood loss or septicemia, which is a terrible way to go.
He documented cases of nearly 50 women who died, most from before the 1940s, but says it's likely a small fraction of the total. He's posted what he found on a blog called Abortion in Colorado.
I'm just very grateful that we don't live in those times.
That's novelist and former journalist Sandra Dallas. She joined us at the library.
My husband's mother died from a self-induced abortion in 1933. And I can only imagine how that changed his life. He was an infant at the time.
Dallas says many of the stories are filled with tragedy, and the focus of the news stories is mostly on the women, not the fathers.
What was your first reaction when you read Alex's blog and, you know, heard about his project?
A couple of reactions. First, that he had done a heck of a job in putting all this together, because I'd never read anything like this about Colorado. And secondly, how sad it was.
Hernandez says a number of stories stand out, like one from 1901, involving a shop girl named Maud. She falls in love and gets pregnant and later seeks care.
She was in the hospital, deathly ill, and the doctor told her he wouldn't work on her any further until she said who had done this.
The story generated headlines and a kind of editorial cartoon on her plight in the Rocky Mountain News, with the last frame showing a body in a morgue. It also included the first image Hernandez could find of a Colorado woman who died from an abortion.
It's kind of blaming her for the situation. But we do have her photo, which I think is quite haunting.
For abortion rights supporters, the research, the history, is relevant today as women in states where the procedure is now severely limited scramble for options. Here's Adrian Manzanares, the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains.
It's happening in Texas now. It's happening in Oklahoma now. It's not far away. It's now in a very contemporary way happening state by state.
After a 2022 Supreme Court decision known as Dobbs overturned Roe, a number of red states have limited abortion rights. Colorado, where that access is protected, has seen a sharp increase in people coming here for the procedure. Manzanares says it's a matter of health care.
It is an incredibly dangerous thing to have a pregnancy and to give birth. But we don't talk about that, and we don't look at that.
Dr. Nancy Fong of the Comprehensive Women's Health Clinic agrees and says medicine has advanced in recent decades, but
I think it's worse than Back to the Future, because we live in a world where we have the technology, we have the medicine to prevent anything like that from happening.
Those on the other side don't see it that way. Will Duffy is president of Colorado Right to Life, which opposes abortion. He says whether today or decades ago, the intentional termination of a pregnancy is wrong.
There are always going to be inherent risks with committing crimes. And so abortion is not an exception to that.
Hernandez's research is limited to mostly what can be found in the newspapers and letters of the day. But he hopes it'll help people understand the state's long history of abortion. I'm John Daly, CPR News.
Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains is a CPR supporter, but has no editorial influence. And Colorado Matters continues in this next half hour with the plain truth. Do aircraft really check your speed? I'm Ryan Warner. You're with CPR News and KRCC.
Terra Firma, the podcast that brings you sounds of nature with reflections from Colorado-born writer C. Marie Fuhrman, is back.
Season 2 offers a chance for us to see the ways in which nature allows our wildness. I believe the Earth is so glad you are here.
Find Terra Firma from Colorado Public Radio wherever you get your podcasts.
Supported by Credit Union of Colorado.
The signs say speed checked by aircraft. You've probably seen them as you drive down the highway. But are planes really policing you? A few of you have asked us through Colorado Wonders. So we drove mostly the speed limit to a place with the answer. The airport in Centennial in the South Denver suburbs, where I met Nate Reed, trooper with the Colorado State Patrol. He is one of the pilots who, yes, actually checks your speed in a little Cessna 182 parked on this particular day in the patrol's hangar. Nate, thanks for having us in the cockpit. This is the very plane that you do speed patrols in.
It is, yes. Thanks for coming out.
So the signs that say speed checked by airplane, they're not just empty deterrents.
They aren't. We do this kind of work by aircraft. We've been doing it for about 55 years using airplanes for speed enforcement and traffic control. It's a way to help the guys on the ground, and it's really an effective tool from the safety standpoint.
Indeed, the Coloradans who wrote in were skeptical. Darren Thornberry from Lafayette told us he thought it might be a bluff. Thornberry has seen the sign on I-25 between Denver and Colorado Springs.
Every time I've driven past that, I've thought, how? You never see a plane flying around low enough that you would imagine is trying to clock your speed. All the questions, such curiosity.
I guess to Darren's point, do you have to fly all that low to do this work?
We don't have to fly all that low. Usually we start about 1,500 feet off the ground. We could be up, you know, as high as 2,000 feet, depending on what the weather is doing and other air traffic and things like that.
And you are always working in tandem with someone on the ground, an officer on the ground, correct?
That's correct. We coordinate before we even go out to an area. We'll decide, you know, if they have enough troopers available, they'll meet us out there with several, and we'll do an op for 2 to 3 hours.
This would be presumably on a stretch of road where people have been speeding, that perhaps has seen a lot of accidents. And how precisely are you measuring someone's speed? Do I picture you in this cockpit with a radar gun?
There's no radar gun, and it's just old-fashioned math. Time over distance, and it's a very simple formula. We do have a stopwatch that assists us with calculating the speed. We use the marks on the edge of the roadway that are spaced exactly 1/2 mile apart. My stopwatch will work the calculation for me. So when I see a vehicle's front bumper cross the plane of that first mark, I will start the stopwatch. And then as they continue to pass the marks, if it's a 3 mile stretch, I'll do it for 6 times and I'll get that many speed clocks on that distance of roadway.
Those marks on the road, are those specifically on the road for you, for plane enforcement?
They are. Aircraft troopers put them in, and we put them in all over. We've put them in from Sterling into Alamosa, up 285 near Fairplay, all the way down to the New Mexico state line on I-25, and then up to the Wyoming border.
I'll just say, your yoke indeed has this blue stopwatch that I don't know, might imagine you'd see at a track meet. It all seems pretty low tech. So then you're doing that calculation at the same time you're flying?
Yeah. At first, when you first start doing it, it is not the easiest task there is. But after you do it a few times, and every trooper pilot that we have in here is a very competent aviator, and they fly the airplane first. And then once they can grasp flying the airplane well and communicating with people on the ground, then we start them on traffic control.
Okay, so with those marks, you're able to verify and verify and verify that someone is indeed breaking the speed limit. So then you radio down to the trooper and you say, red Corvette, pull him over.
That's right. You'll see it. So you look out the window. And we have high-wing Cessna airplanes. So we have an unobstructed view down to the ground, and we fly left circles. I'm in the left seat. I'll see a vehicle that's speeding. I'll start my clocks, and after I get my first clock, I say, yeah, there's a red Corvette in the number one lane going 94 miles an hour. So I will speak to that trooper and tell him, hey, and this is the mile point I started the clocks. This is what time I started the clocks, and then I'll count down till he gets to him. So the next set of marks, I'll say, this red Corvette, still in the number one lane, past the semi, past three other vehicles, and then as they get to the trooper, I'll say, okay, one Charlie Four, I have that red Corvette's about one mark away. It's about a quarter mile to you. I say, get your roll going. So he starts his roll because he's got to try to match his speed. And then, okay, one Charlie Four, I need you to speed up. And then he'll be the number one car off your right side. He's off the right side now. They'll observe that car. And I say, that is the correct vehicle next to you in the right lane. And when he gets behind the vehicle, I'll talk him all the way through.
So it's not as if there's an airplane in the air all the time.
We have two airplanes that are capable of doing this, and we have coverage that can last 7 days. So any given day, you know, this airplane can be up two different times. So we could do a 3-hour shift in the morning and then a 3-hour shift at night, and we can work a different area. You know, like I said, we have marks, you know, from Sterling to Alamosa to Trinidad to Fort Collins, almost to Laramie, and we have them in Lamar. I mean, we have them all over Colorado.
Lamar on the plains. So if I were driving, would I recognize these marks? I've got to say, I can't even conjure what they look like.
Yeah, if you're looking for them, you would absolutely see them. They don't always accompany a sign that says speed monitored by aircraft, but oftentimes they're just a big white mark on the side of the road that looks kind of like a crosswalk. They're about a foot wide white solid mark that either go on the outside shoulder or the inside shoulder, and they're spaced exactly 1.5 mile apart.
Another hypothesis shared with us, Nate, is that you might use drones. Mm. Heather Ruddy, who lives here in Centennial, had that thought.
Back in the day, back when I was little, just kind of pictured like a prop airplane or something flying overhead and following cars down the road. And I think the simple answer right now would be, oh, it's probably just drones.
Not a drone. I am sitting in what is very much a Cessna. Where is this technology headed? Because Nate, I gotta say, it feels a little analog.
But a very effective analog tool. Drones, I don't think we're there yet, but I can tell you that the technology that we have currently on board this aircraft right now, we can get rid of the marks tomorrow and we can affect the whole state, and wouldn't have to be one stretch of road. It could be any road anywhere. So if we have a problem, a particular area that we're seeing an increase in fatal and injury crashes, we can focus on that area and try to bring that down by strict enforcement.
And what is that technology that's already on board? And it sounds like you are using in tandem. And by the way, this requires a second person. This is not a solo affair.
That's correct. We have technology on this airplane that has video recording capabilities. And within that video capability, it runs through a computer that also has overlays. So the second trooper that would be on board this airplane could ascertain someone's speed by use of just touching the monitor. It would drop markers. At the end, it will show us a speed. And we only need a quarter mile of distance to ascertain someone's speed. And then you can delete markers, and then you can start all over again. All while the most important part is videotaping their sometimes egregious driving action.
And so instead of paint markers on the road surface, the screen and the ability to customize it is doing that work.
That's right. We are limited right now. If our markers, because we have snow here in Colorado, so the snowplows oftentimes will lift up the painted lines that we have on the side of the shoulders, because our plow drivers do such a good job here in Colorado of moving snow from even the shoulder where we put our markers, that now we'll have technology that we won't even need that. We can go to any road in any municipality, any highway, any state highway, anywhere, and we could do this type of work.
But you are doubling the staff.
We would be doubling the staff. In the meantime, we're going to continue to fly over highways with stopwatches in our hands and use painted marks on the road.
Do tickets ever come in the mail after this kind of enforcement, or is it always that you're pulling people over?
You will always have a trooper stop you after an airplane ascertains your speed.
Is a ticket issued because of air patrol? Is it more expensive in any way, or that is totally related to the violation?
It's just a violation. And we're not just looking for speed. We're looking for people that are driving unsafe, you know, passing on the shoulder, making unsafe passes. We're also looking for commercial motor vehicles, violating the left lane law, or speeding themselves, or driving recklessly.
This can be life-saving, huh? I mean, I've seen people driving on highways where I think, boy, if that keeps up, there's going to be a serious accident.
Yeah, the things that I see from the air is insane to me. I don't see them in a marked patrol car when I'm on the side of the road working as a regular trooper capacity on the side of the road. People are aware of marked patrol cars, even unmarked patrol cars, and they tend to drive better when they see those type of things. So having a vantage point from the air is much different, and people don't know you're there, and they continue to drive the way they drive, and it's shocking sometimes. You know, in these areas that we're working, you know, we can affect a 3 or 4 mile stretch of road, and we could be there for 3 hours and, you know, stop 25 cars. And if I'm working on the road, I can't stop that many cars. There's just not the volume of terrible drivers around me. It just doesn't happen.
Because you get a much larger viewpoint from the air than a single trooper would have on the ground. That's why you'd be able to say this guy and this guy and that gal and this guy and this person. And
Yeah. My view is much larger. You know, you driving home today, you look around you. What can you see? You know, you can only see the 5 or 6 cars that are immediately in your area. But this offers a unique perspective. And, you know, we stop multiple vehicles at one time because, you know, you think you're riding with a crew or you're following the guy in front of you. And we'll stop 4 or 5 cars if we got enough troopers to stop them all.
Whoa, really? I always thought the guy in front of me would be pulled over first and that I'm off scot-free because it's his fault. I'm just following him,
yeah.
Officer.
Yeah, and we get that a lot too. And if I have one trooper, I'll give the trooper the option. I say, hey, are you able to stop 2 cars? If they say no, I'll say, okay, would you like the front vehicle or the back vehicle? They're both going the same speed. I have evidence on both of them. I have 2 stopwatches that are fixed to my yoke. I have clocks on both cars. Which one would you like? So it's not always the front one that's going to get it. Sometimes the back one gets it.
Well, this answers Heather Ruddy's question. She wanted to know, as someone who's worked in local government in the past, what the kind of return on investment is.
What's the ROI if you're sending an aircraft up to monitor speeds? You know, do tickets pay for that? There's definitely a cost-benefit analysis, I think, that goes into everything, all public services and public safety.
And the answer is you can stop way more people using the aircraft. Do you notice sometimes when I sense people are going fast around me, I join them? Not because I have some particular, you know, connection to them, but it's its own prophecy, like self-fulfilling prophecy. Do you notice that bad driving kind of metastasizes?
The flow starts to speed up. And I do notice people trying to join them. But I tell you what I also notice. I also notice people sticking to their normal speeds. And I notice people being responsible. And I notice people that move over. And they move over to the far right lane and they slow down. And they say, you know, I'm not gonna be involved in that anymore because it gets to be 10 or 15 miles an hour of the speed limit. We're traveling at such a higher rate of speed. They don't feel comfortable. They get off of the highway. And they'll get back on the highway once that pack of cars is gone.
Well, let's finish by talking about the signs that sparked this whole line of questioning. Are the signs required by law to notify people they're being monitored? Are they fundamentally as well for deterrence?
They are not required statutorily. We don't need to notify anybody of a violation of speed law. It's noted. It says speed limit 75. And that's the only requirement is that those signs are of normal size. And they put the signs that speeds monitored by aircraft as a deterrent. Our goal is voluntary compliance. We want everybody to think there's an airplane up there all the time. Because if we don't have to stop anybody for going 100 miles an hour again, or cover a fatal crash where somebody's been going 100 miles an hour or 80 miles an hour, or whatever speed that hurts people, if we don't ever have to do that again, that's great. We would love voluntary compliance, and that's why the signs are up.
Nate Reed is a Colorado State Patrol trooper and pilot who looks for lead feet. What do you wonder about our state? Submit your question through cpr.org/ColoradoWonders. After a break, Miss America, Her plate so full, it's a wonder she had time for us. This is Colorado Matters from CPR News.
I'm Elise Honeylet-Wee. As a production and technical operations intern for CPR and KRCC, I help produce content you hear on the radio. CPR and KRCC offer opportunities to current students and recent graduates to set up the next generation for success. You can learn more about our internships and fellowships at cpr.org/jobs.
You might not expect to hear this in the talent portion of Miss America, but then again, this isn't your parents' pageant.
Tower, this is Skyhawk 707 Tango Mike at Charlie South, ready to take off on a runway 25. It's my first solo flight, and I am in charge. I'm the pilot in command of this aircraft. To the tower, this little plane is known as Skyhawk 707 Tango Mike. I'm flying at 3,000 feet, and there's no instructor here to check my speed, altitude, or runway spacing. I'm 16 years old, and I alone must rely on my training, instinct, and determination.
That is Madison Marsh during the contest earlier this year. Marsh was indeed 16 when she got her pilot's license. Last year, she graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs and became a second lieutenant. From there to Harvard, where she's working on a master's degree, a project she has put on hold because she won that Miss America crown, the first active duty military officer to hold the title. I spoke to her recently and asked why she wanted to add a crown to her already crowded resume.
I really care a lot about pancreatic cancer work in memory of my mom, and this was just such a wonderful opportunity not only to lead in the Air Force and show people what it means to be an officer, but I also have the national platform to be able to share my mom's story and educate people on pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, your mom died of pancreatic cancer, and talk to me about what that journey was like for you as her daughter and when you knew that you wanted to do something to raise awareness after her passing.
Yes, so she was 41 years old when she passed. She was misdiagnosed for a while and only lasted about 9 months from the moment she was diagnosed to the day that she passed away on November 1st, 2018. So obviously it was pretty tough coming from having a mom that was very young, being diagnosed, not having any of the signs of pancreatic cancer. And so it really shocked us. And it was about 2 weeks after she passed that I was sitting in a gym and I decided that I really wanted to remember my mom for who she was and not what pancreatic cancer made her. So it sparked the Whitney Marsh Foundation and we were able to start running a 5K, 10K race in her memory.
Oh. How does the degree you're studying for at Harvard fit into what you hope to achieve, I guess generally, but maybe with Miss America as well?
So my degree at Harvard is in public policy, but I do research on the Farber Cancer Institute and some people that also are with the Harvard Medical School for pancreatic cancer early detection. And right now we really don't have anyone in the public sphere creating policy to make pancreatic cancer better for patients, to make it more accessible for care. So my role is really understanding the types of research that are going on and the best ways that we can be implementing it so it reaches the most amount of patients back at home.
Do you imagine someday wanting to lobby Congress?
I don't know. I've got some new, very exciting things on the horizon for this next year that I can't talk about quite yet, okay. But I would really love to see more focus in my hometown in Arkansas. We have a very interesting demographic that doesn't necessarily get a lot of attention when it comes to cancer research or cancer care. And some of our care isn't even really centralized. And I want to be able to use the resources in my platform to fix it because every patient deserves a chance to survive. And I want to be able to break down those barriers, whether they be financial or something else, to ensure everyone has equitable access to care.
And so I hear you saying that for you, Miss America is a really awesome platform. It's a chance, in a way, to supercharge your message. But I also think, Madison, that it's kind of a loaded title, Miss America, a loaded idea even. I mean, certainly in the 1950s and 60s, it might have been a dream for a lot of young women, but as women's roles changed, it became more controversial. What prompted getting into pageants in general? I guess before I ask specifically about Miss America, which no doubt has evolved.
So I started it as a freshman at the Air Force Academy, and I was really grieving my mom. I'd lost her the year prior and didn't really know how to be in this new strict military environment and also be myself at the same time. Oh. So that is what kind of sparked this interest and beginning pageants and now obviously getting to be in the Miss America opportunity.
Did someone come up to you and tell you about pageants, or like how did it come onto your radar?
My cousin competed.
Aha. Uh-huh. What did she get out of it that you found alluring?
I can speak specifically to the Miss America opportunity, but really Miss America is all about resume building, leadership opportunities, public speaking, community service, which are a lot of the things that obviously can make you a better person that will exist even outside of pageantry.
How did your academy classmates react when they learned that you were being a part of Miss America?
I mean, they were all very, very excited and supportive of me.
Your predecessor, by the way, Miss America 2023, was a nuclear engineer. So what did it bring to you then? Because you were talking about balancing the grief you were experiencing, the life you knew before the academy, and then the rigors of the academy. Adding one more thing doesn't seem like the necessarily the solve-all, but how did it help?
I mean, a lot of these different communities seem like they're disconnected, but they're not to me. Obviously, service is kind of the crux of everything. I serve in my uniform as second lieutenant. I serve as the president and founder of the Whitney Marsh Foundation to be able to help families all around us. And I also serve as Miss America to be able to reach all other people and all other Americans to kind of be a voice in that area. And so I think service is the biggest thing for me. And even though they seem disconnected, they're really not at the end of the day.
I love this idea of service because I find that when I am stressed or when I'm in my head, the thing that can get me out of it is to think about other people and being of service to others. I wonder if that resonates with you.
I think that's really true. One of the things that I tried to teach my cadets at the academy was that you need to be able to serve outside of your uniform, because we serve in a very obvious way to our country, which is very important. But I think when our cup is full and overflowing, we need to be able to give that to other people that need it. And so I would always go take them to different volunteering organizations around the state of Colorado to have that time to be a family unit as a squadron and be able to give back some of our energy to the people that need it.
Yeah, because as a senior, you oversaw, you supervised, if you will, cadets. I just want to note that there was a big shift for Miss America in 2019 when organizers announced, quote, sweeping changes. Candidates will no longer be judged on physical appearance. And I don't know, reading that, I thought to myself, I sort of wish society as a whole would make that same declaration. No longer judged on physical appearance. Do you feel judged by your looks outside of pageant life?
I don't really know, perhaps, but if it is something that is being done, then I don't really give it any thought, because what I'm here to focus on isn't my looks. I'm here to focus on serving my country properly as an officer in the United States Air Force. I'm here to focus on making the lives better for pancreatic cancer patients who aren't really given the chance to survive right now. So if people are focusing on it, I'm not.
Let's go back a ways to you becoming a pilot at age 16. What spoke to you about flying medicine?
I had a dream for a long time of becoming an astronaut, and I knew the best way to becoming an astronaut was becoming a military pilot, and the best place to do that is going to the United States Air Force Academy. And so I knew I wanted to be competitive and start that love of flying early, and that's exactly what I did by starting flying at a young age.
And what's your relationship today to the idea of becoming an astronaut?
You know, I've now gone into a newer area trying to focus on pancreatic cancer. Mm-hmm. Priorities change, life changes, passions change, and I'm definitely not the same person I was whenever I was 12, so...
Do you often get to meet other young women, high achieving, you know, and like yourself, very, very busy? And if so, what conversations do you have with them? Like, what message do you try to leave them with?
Really just trying to recognize your own passions, and that there's going to be a lot of people that try to put their input on who they think you should be, on what they think you should be doing. But at the end of the day, it's your life. And every moment that you do something that you don't like is a moment that's wasted. So staying true to yourself, staying true to your passions, and knowing your heart to guide yourself and not letting other people oversway that.
Huh. Were there ways that you felt pressure to do things that you didn't want to do that wouldn't have made you happy?
I mean, I definitely had a lot of people telling me I needed to just pick one thing. And that wasn't really true to my identity, so I didn't. And I think if I would have listened to them and given up a lot of the things that I cared about, I wouldn't be the young woman that I am today.
Well, thanks for making time for us. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Air Force Second Lieutenant Madison Marsh is the first military officer to serve as Miss America. First, of course, she was Miss Colorado and graduated from the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And that is Colorado Matters for today. I'm Ryan Warner. Thanks for spending time with us at CPR News and KRCC.